you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Ryan Dawson back on the show. Ryan, how are you doing?
Good. I always enjoy your interviews. We're all different topics, but it's always good.
Thank you. Thank you. And of course, I find your show, your various interviews and postings very informative, as well as your documentaries. How is your – the last time I talked to you, you were trying to work on a JFK documentary. How's that coming along?
It's turned into a JFK and RFK documentary.
Oh, I'm surprised.
I just felt like, well, people will be mad if I don't go all the way. So
yeah,
just explain it both. So it's moving along slow.
Okay, well, that's good. Well,
there's so much disinfo to sift through there, you know. And I was working on that with Michael Piper, and then he passed away.
Yeah.
So that slowed it down also.
Yeah, in a moment, if in that community, if you disagree with somebody or there's some dispute, there's accusations back and forth. There's a lot of disagreement in that.
Oh, yeah. Because
there is so much disinfo. And also, I think in many respects, people with good intentions, just people just simply disagree, then they get on, you know, they have their individual corner angle on it.
It's kind of campish, like this camp and that camp kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I've never been that kind of person. That's how I sifted through all the 9/11 stuff. It was – that stuff's very
– same thing, tribal. Really, yeah.
And I'm just looking at the primary sources and evidence. And again, in that, I was more interested in who than the specifics of what kind of explosive or something minute didn't matter to me. And I was so tired of seeing people talk about Building 7's, you know, speed or whatever. Like, look, we've got foreign operatives from an intelligence agency of another country filming the first plane hitting. Why don't we start there? So same thing with Kennedy is I ignored a lot of the typical paths like, oh, they're mad about the Bay of Pigs and so this happened.
Yeah.
I just ignored that and looked straight at who I knew was involved. My Kennedy film starts out centered on Jack Ruby, and I kind of unspiral from there. And that was a lot harder to decide than you can imagine because there's so many players. And I was thinking, who is the central person that I could kind of start with and then tell this story because there's so much involved.
Now, because you are the host of the Anti-Neocon Report, ANC Report, just to plug that. Yeah. Okay. And well, tonight I want to discuss Well, a topic you've made a video about, neocolonialism, and also its relation to maybe to drug trafficking, arms dealing, human trafficking, the fomenting of wars, destabilization. And you also had a recent discussion with Doug Valentine regarding his new book, CIA is Organized Crime. And
yeah, Doug Valentine is the man, dude. When it comes to organized crime, read Doug Valentine books, because there's a lot on that subject too. But that Strength of the Pack and Strength of the Wolf book series are on it now. He has this new one about the CIA as organized crime. And a couple of interviews I did with him are transcribed into that book. Mm-hmm. It's kind of puts it all together, all his previous books, The Phoenix Program, which people really need to understand because that's really the model for the Department of Homeland Security.
That's right.
And that was, so he goes through organized crime, 70s, 80s, up to now. And I'd hate to make a movie about all that, but I'm glad there are books on it because some things are just too big to tackle. And
And he does. He explains. He demystifies a lot of this stuff, and you understand the human element to the angle to it, and how he did his investigation. You know, he talks about how he was sort of, he was taken in. There were people like Colby liked him, his approach, so he was able to get access to this to these various characters who were involved.
Yeah, William Colby told him, and then he would approach other people, and they assumed, well, if the former DCI is saying so, then I guess I can tell you things.
Yeah. He wrote the book about his father, Hotel to Caliban or something. And then they read that book and they figured he understand, the mentality or the lives of soldiers and CIA, operatives.
They think of themselves as soldiers,
Yeah. And so, he was well versed in poetry, I think Scottish poetry or something, how he got the confidence of that one guy, and he just kind of
Parker. Well, yeah. He was Welsh, and he knows the Welsh poetry and literature, and Doug's study of philosophy and things like that got him more rapport with these people than a kind of classic journalism avenue would have gotten him, because he could actually relate to them and the things they're interested in, and the classic reporter hitting with hard questions, they would have gotten ignored.
Yeah, so. It is funny. He had gone to the Columbia School of Journalism and gotten his certificate. He never would have found all this information. And because the program itself, a lot of these operations, it was so compartmentalized, he himself was able to see the bigger picture and talk to these different individuals and understand it in a way that the various operatives never could have understood it, because he saw the bigger picture and how they're all interrelated.
Well, also, Doug knew a lot about the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. It's been renamed and taken over by the CIA now, but those paths cross because it starts with the State Department and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and the CIA takes over the drug trade nowadays. They're the biggest drug cartel on earth. But those kind of systems had been fomenting long before this OSS existed. I mean, all through the 30s and the Good Neighbors policy, you had the TACA, which is kind of like Air America. I mean, it's the same template, right? They were dealing drugs for Korea and Honduras and working with the governor in Louisiana. And later you have Edwin, the new governor after O.K. Allen and his successors, working with Barry Seal. And then that operation got moved to MENA in Arkansas. But that New Orleans Syndicate and the Carcello brothers and the DA in Miami, these are all the same factions that become CIA station chiefs, et cetera, with Shackley and the rest of these ghosts who facilitate the drug trade and help with illegal arms markets. That the guys who are supposed to be policing this stuff are the ones doing more of it than anyone.
Yeah. And both, I think, as you pointed out, I think Doug agreed with you, it's the drug war is more about managing and controlling than stopping it. And, like anything, if you're going to have full spectrum dominance, you're not going to let the black markets operate independently. You're going to control those as well. You're going to create the black markets because the black markets themselves create the opportunity not only to get fabulously wealthy, but also to conduct operations that otherwise maybe wouldn't pass the
oversight. how did so and so have enough revenue to pull this off and on this the drugs?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really large black market, which allows off the book operations. And that's what the CIA wanted. They used to call it the Enterprise. And the Enterprise was just the CIA trying to go to set up something off the shelf. So they would have a sort of public-ish or government-ish CIA, but then the real CIA was all offshore. And they really moved a lot of operations out of Langley and over into Saudi Arabia with the Safari Club. And you know, that explains what they were doing in the 80s and 90s with BCCI and so on. That, a lot of that information is in one of my documentaries called The Empire Unmasked. Mm-hmm. Which could have been 20 hours long if I wanted to really sit and go through it, but
yeah,
one day I'll do an Iran-Contra film as well. But yeah, the CIA is in the business of managing drugs, and they have their paws in the in ICE and the DEA. And I mean, the DEA was using cash from coke busts to finance illegal arms being secretly built in Arkansas, as well as training pilots, you know, in the, just north of MENA. And the governor there covered it up. His name was Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But that all the CIA is the center of all of that. And this Phoenix program that Doug has also explained is the organizing mechanism of the way they organize everything, and the way they create layers of plausible deniability between themselves and all these middlemen so that they can facilitate organized crime.
Yeah, and also, if you look at the Vietnam War, I think you described it as the helicopter heroin war, and it's a good way to simplify.
That. Yeah, I think so. I call it the war of helicopters and heroin, and I hope that becomes a thing. I hope people start referring to Vietnam as helicopters and heroin.
And the point there is, it was an opportunity to waste a whole lot of money on armaments and weapons platforms, but also to ship in heroin, but also to create a market for heroin. You know, you sort of prime the pump by addicting soldiers, and then they come back to America, and voila, you got a market back here in America. But also, it was also an opportunity to test weapons. And one mm-hmm. of those weapons you could see was the Phoenix program, because it's been applied domestically. In fact, it's been applied internationally, as I think Doug quotes that one general who says, we need a Phoenix. Was it Michael Flynn? I think it was Michael Flynn, the one who just resigned as National Security Advisor. I think it was him.
The DIA. He was the head of the DIA, yeah. And he used to be the National Security Advisor. He's been fired.
So, yeah, and apparently he didn't realize he might be being recorded when he's talking to the Russian ambassador. But that's a whole other level of intrigue.
He was very anti-Iran anyway, so good riddance. But
yeah, I know he was into that. But he, I think it was him. I might be another general who proposed that in the war on terror we need a global Phoenix program. So.
I can see several of them saying such a thing.
Yeah,
it is like that, though. I mean, that's what the CIA does. They go and they take. That's what they did in Ukraine. Is first they buy up property. That's sort of step one, so they can mm-hmm. have their little base of operations, and then they start going after the civil society. And it's just like Vietnam, and that was a template for that, and it didn't work. Other than it created a huge drug market and made a lot of money for the CIA, didn't win the war,
mm-hmm.
but that was never the goal.
No, it wasn't. It was just
the goal was to prolong conflict for as long as possible so that they could continue profiteering, and that's what the MIC wanted to do. They had a new toy, and Bell had a lot of helicopters, and Johnson was one of their lackeys. He worked for Kellogg Brown and Root, which is now Halliburton Kellogg Brown and Root, mm-hmm. before he became vice president and then president. And he was involved with the mafia as well. All of them are. I mean, they run a show. They realize that. And all these mob syndicates grew, especially post-World War II, because that's when black markets really rise, is when cities have been decimated. A lot of people turn to selling drugs or prostitution, which organized crime benefits the most from. And a lot of the Sicilian syndicates were actually allies of the United States against Mussolini. And I think Giovesi, well, he was a liaison there. And they were setting up governors, mayors, everything. So these mob syndicates got a real boost everywhere globally. I mean, Yakuza was the same thing. The CIA relied heavily on Yakuza to spy on China and continue Japanese operations, because Japan had taken Manchuria from China, and they had annexed all of Korea, too, north and south. So they were already in there, and the CIA got these right-wing Yakuza groups to bash leftist protesters, all under the pretext of stopping communism, but they weren't all communists. And no, I definitely am not a communist either, but that's not really what was happening. It was just a pretext to bash labor unions and so on.
Yeah, and you use the mob to do that, particularly like in Italy, and then you know, the communists threatened to win the election, so you use the mob to suppress the vote there and intimidate the unions there. You also have, well, good example, in right after the war in Japan, you had the seizure. Japan had, you know, had plundered a lot in its, I guess, mm-hmm. 15 years of occupying Asia, because it started in the 30s, really. You have this huge...
a lot longer than that, even. They had about 40 years, so yeah.
That's right, 1890s. You had, you know, this the whole thing about Yamashita's gold and this huge gold hoard that apparently MacArthur staff found out about. And this involved, I think, what's his name? The guy in the Philippines who, you know, the advertising guy who was involved in the Kennedy assassination. The general.
Well, you remind me of something else about the Kodama scandal also with Lockheed. But talking about gold, when Matthew Perry first came over in the 1850s, there was a gold scandal in Japan too, where they were not being paid the right ratio between currencies with coins, and the Japanese finally figured this out and put an end to it. But the foreigners had been raping gold from Japan from its inception, and so it's a bit not poetic justice. It's just ironic, I guess, that
that is funny.
The will rise again after the world wars.
Yeah, and Matthew Perry, his show.
Saint Eugene Caesar, who you're thinking about in the Philippines, probably.
I'm sorry? Still there.
Eugene Caesar is in the Philippines.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I'm thinking, you know, what's his name? The guy, the old Air Force general. Name's failing me now. He was an admin.
It'll come to me in a minute.
I know.
My head's been around Iran-Contra lately because I've been working up. So I'm like, it'll come to me. Randomly, I'll be like, blah, blah, blah.
Lansdale. General Lansdale.
Lansdale.
Yeah. He was always an Air Force general, but he's really CIA, which goes to, you know, how they infiltrate these. Curtis LeMay accepted him as a general.
Yeah, the same. I totally know who he is, but the same thing happened to me the other day where I was trying to remember a Brad Pitt film, Benjamin Button, and I was like, what is the Curious Tale of? I finally got hold of a phone. I was like, oh, that's what it was. But I wouldn't tell my friend who also couldn't think of it. It was driving them nuts.
Well, that's what happens. I mean, it's like,
I really hate that, though. That happens to me. I'm like, what the? Like, I forgot a hijacker's name one time, and I don't know how many hundred times I've.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
I had a discussion. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a discussion about I was having a discussion with a guy about the mob in Las Vegas and the Kennedy assassination, and we both couldn't remember the name Johnny Roselli. And finally, I came up with it.
Yeah, Roselli.
You know, Johnny Hansen. Yeah, what's his name? Then I go, oh, you meant Johnny? You know, Johnny Roselli? Yeah, that's it.
Well, you Roselli. Know, that sometimes I remember their nicknames, like Jimmy Blue Eyes or Babyface or something, and I'm like, oh yeah, it's Bugsy Siegel. But yeah, you go by their nicknames. A lot. Mm-hmm. The Jacob Rubenstein is, everyone knows him as Jack Ruby. Nobody says Rubenstein, you know, but that is his name. And it's so you get kind of sucked into that too by their nicknames in the media.
But as far as that goes, there's a huge slush fund, the you know, this gold hoard. And also in Europe, you also had the Black Eagle Trust, which was capitalized with this hoard of treasure that the Germans had acquired during the war. And of course, when the war ends, it's used to negotiate Operation Paperclip, and Alan Dulles is there in Switzerland negotiating with, I guess, General Wolf of the SS, and it gets in the really, you know, entangled.
Paperclip was a lot more expansive than people believe. They think that was just Nazi scientists and stuff. That was some of it, but it was much larger than that. Fletcher Plowey, who's not always right, but he did dig into that and exposed that a lot in one of his JFK books, which is really the book about Vietnam. JFK's in the title. It does get into this song, but Operation Paperclip was a lot bigger than people realize.
And it gets into, of course, neocolonialism, or because the whole ideology behind the exploitation of the developing world is the way to prevent it from developing and competing in their eyes for resources and maintaining dominance, the Anglo-American dominance, Anglo-American desire dominance of the world, is by impoverishing and immiserating the third world through low intensity conflict. Low intensity conflict, and also economic warfare, which is arguably more deadly. But you made it, getting onto neocolonialism. Maybe how should, we should really address this is you made a video. It's about a 20-minute video about neocolonialism, and you focus on Africa. And this is a good way to, because Africa is a good case study of this, and so is Latin America, and so is Asia for that.
Latin America could have been, but I felt like I don't know, why not just do Africa.
But the
reason I was going to give a talk at a university in Japan in Kobe, and they had some African diplomats there, and I think Vice President Scott from Zambia was going to be there. He's president now, so I thought, okay, I will use Zambia as my case study, because I could have picked anything really. So I talked about the copper mines there to explain the sort of system that's happening with commodity companies. And there's a series of things. I mean, people have to basically, they need to understand there are a lot of different methods. I mean, sometimes the paramilitary groups, like in Somalia, things like that, are corrupt commodity companies like in Nigeria or Zambia, etc. Nigeria also deals with terrorist proxy forces like Boko Haram. And that's the three main methods, really. And you can steal through banking, you can steal through force, or both. And all of the above are happening, but what you realize if you watch Neocolonialism in Africa, I know it's not a very clever title, but if people watch that, it's only like 23 minutes or something, I feel like they'll get a grasp of saying, oh, that's all a government is. It's just a managing arm over resources, where the plebs may work on the free market, but all the real money is tied to government. They have the control over the real meat and potatoes of the of whatever resources are available, and control everything and enrich themselves. And that's what a lot of these despots in Africa were set up to do, is to act as the management arm of commodity companies in Europe.
Well, a good example of that, I think we have, disaster that's been going on for several years in the Congo, which goes underreported. Millions and millions of deaths have occurred because
That's the thing. Millions have died, and it doesn't get the attention of even Syria or even Palestine, which are also horrible situations. But yeah, the Congo, I mean, you've got guys like Paul Kagame, who used to work as he was sort of like the CIA of Uganda, their intelligence agency. And now then he became the president of Rwanda. And the Rwandan government and military would go into the Congo, and they were murdering 100 people a day by rope, by axe, etc., and for resource wars, of course. And one of the biggest monsters in history was King Leopold in Belgium. His name ought to be right up there on the tip of your tongue when people like to rattle off Hitler, Stalin, etc. They should be talking about this Belgian king, because he really showed the model of how you could create a civil society like the CIA does, a little elite of Africans you pay off and help them enforce your will on the rest of the country and make it – let them do it for you. And he set up the model in the Congo, and millions died, and they're still dying. And the only time I think the DRC was mentioned in recent history was it was one of the supposed sources of yellow cake uranium. It was the DRC in Niger for Bush's lies about uranium from Africa going to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Of course, it wasn't true. That's the last time they've really been on the map. And actually, I believe CNN put them in the wrong place. They had Cameroon.
Well, it's a big continent.
Yeah, but come on.
Well, it's a very dark and mysterious continent. Harder darkness, right? But the a good example, I remember a couple, was it last year when that tourist dentist shot and killed that lion and everyone was an uproar about it?
And yeah, the lion died.
They got more press than the millions of people have been murdered in the Congo in the past decade. And
yeah, I'm sad that any kind of endangered species or whatever, lion, tiger, something is shot, but come on. Those people mm-hmm. are starving to death in the Horn of Africa. There are people being murdered in the Congo and in Nigeria. And there was a little bit of news when all those schoolgirls got kidnapped and you had Michelle Obama with her sign, "Bring back our girls." And mm-hmm. of course that all faded away and they never did get them out. But that was about it really with Nigeria. And they were making over $108 million or something from oil trade and people are living on less than $2 a day. And you have to ask yourself, what's wrong? Like, what's wrong with almost every place in Africa? Why is the most resource-rich continent in the world home to some of the poorest countries? Like, how can that happen? How could they mismanage their resources so much? But you realize they're not managing it on behalf of their own interests. They're hand-selected by foreigners for their own interests, especially commodity companies like Glencore, which Mark Rich was integral in before he passed away. He was a Mossad agent, by the way. He helped procure a lot of weapons from Israel to South Africa and enable the diamond trade. And he also worked in Iran-Contra, and he also worked in getting wheat to the Soviet Union in exchange for Jewish migrants to Israel. He's such a character. One of his lawyers was Louis Levy, by the way. He was Dick Cheney's chief of staff. And involved in the Plame affair, which actually gets back to the Niger forgeries, which was about the uranium in the DRC, which we were talking about just a minute ago. So mm-hmm. there's a full circle. But
and did he get rich? Denise Rich, Hillary Clinton, from Crown, correct? His wife?
Yeah, didn't, your mic or something is
okay, got fuzzy.
But I think you said, yeah, I think you asked me about Denise Rich, who was Mark Rich's wife, and she financed. It's Mark Rich doing it, but Denise Rich financed Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign. And then there was also the New Square New York scandal, where these Hasidic Jews got over $11 million to set up fictitious schools. They didn't really exist, you know, for Jewish schools. Were getting all these government subsidies, and they helped finance Hillary's Senate race. But that's a drop in the bucket for the Clintons and how they themselves.
But it's funny because the reason why Denise Rich had to do, can you hear me okay now?
Oh yeah, it's clear now.
Okay. The reason why Denise Rich had to be the proxy for that is because I think Mark Rich was on the lam, right? until the final day.
Well, yeah, he was on Interpol's most wanted list.
Yeah, so.
And but not for his bigger crimes. It was for his tax evasion. So you see, the government's like, oh, you ain't paying us? Well, now you're going to jail. But of course, he never did. But it was because of his because Clinton gave him a pardon his last hour in office. But because they were purchasing pardons, Pincus Green got a pardon too. That he was a partner of Mark Rich, and these guys were involved in child trafficking, like the worst stuff you can imagine. Like the neocolonialism movie I made didn't get into that part because it's not a Mark Rich movie. But maybe I should make a Mark Rich movie. But I was talking about transfer pricing, which is really vital in understanding how they get around tax laws. Like a lot of well-meaning, I think, liberals think, well, why doesn't Africa or wherever, Detroit, etc., just raise taxes on the wealthy and redistribute the money to the poor or something? That doesn't work because it's better to have half a loaf of bread than none. Mm-hmm. And if you raise the taxes too high, they're just going to move the profits offshore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happens. There's clever ways of having your own subsidiaries sell things to each other at a loss, but while you own both.
Yes, yeah.
And count it like that on the books and move the revenue around. And, well, why don't you make all that stuff illegal? Like, why don't you just lower the taxes?
It's also assuming that the local satraps care about the people when they're installed by the corporations, you know, who are represented by the Central Intelligence Agency. you know.
So, oh, exactly. Yeah. Or intelligence agencies of other countries like Kagame was. I mean, you're talking about guys that were spending millions of dollars just on themselves to buy a bunch of ties and suits and custom-made alligator skin shoes and stuff. I mean, corruption there is unfathomable. But, you know, if a business gets a loan from a bank and they don't pay it back, the worst thing that can happen is they go out of business. But when a country does it, when a government official takes a predatory loan on purpose so that he can personally profit or she can personally profit, it's at the expense of the entire nation. Everybody has to pay when the country takes a loan. That's why you got to separate business and state. Like businesses screw up, they'll fail. And that's what the market's natural regulation is. Mm-hmm. Well, pay money back, you go out of business. But a government doesn't go out of business. It just goes to the next government. So the debt ends up on the, you know, the entire electorate, if there is an electorate, on the entire population. They have to pay it either through rapid inflation, hyperinflation, or through taxes.
Yeah, that predatory lending scheme is how the economic hitman model functions.
Perkins talks about it. Is it John Perkins?
It's Confessions of Economic Hitman, and you read that book, you realize how, you know, one, you find out why there is this massive third world debt. Because when you're dealing with the fractional reserve banking system, which is fiat currency, the money itself is just, you know, created out of thin air. And if you're in a position to create the money out of thin air and loan it out and claim the collateral, the real wealth, you're not really at the meta level. The people running the show aren't at any risk at all, because at the end of the day, they're able to collect, through the blood, sweat, and misery.
You can make it more simple than that. It's like, I'm a bank. You're a guy and you have some assets. You have some land. Maybe you have a shop or whatever. You have a hotel or what? You have some store. And you come to me and I don't think you can pay the loan. So, of course, I loan you money. Because if you don't pay it back, I'm going to end up with your store or your land or your whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a clever way of seizing assets, is they overloan to people when they know they're in trouble. And yet, if you're a business that's doing well and being responsible, I don't really benefit much other than the small interest rate I can gain, because you'll pay that back and you'll expand your business. They're much more interested in seizing assets from people, and then they can sell them for pennies on the dollar to themselves or their buddies. And that's what was happening during the housing bubble. It happened really bad in the Soviet Union. That's how the oligarchs were able to gobble up all these different industries. Of course, there was worse than that happening there. They had false appraisals and rigged elections. They didn't allow venture capitalists to actually compete. They just rigged it. And Boris Berezovsky and DeProska and people like that just walked away with all the nickel and aluminum and all the vital industries that the communists had, just ended up in the hands of about seven different oligarchs, billionaires.
Yeah, who were working for London, City of London and Wall Street at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, actually, Berezovsky, now that you mentioned that, he was working with Rupert Murdoch from Australia, but same difference, because he has ties in London too.
Yeah.
And a lot of them fled to the UK, which does not have an extradition treaty with Russia. Once they were caught, Putin put some of them in jail. The rest were exiled. And they weren't really ever punished, because they just went and bought soccer teams.
I was about to say they bought, you know, soccer teams and ice hockey teams, apparently, and are apparently corrupting that now. Yep. that's a whole other.
Berezovsky died, like, so I can talk about him since he died. I'm not scared. he was involved with that whole Litvinenko polonium poisoning stuff. And it saddened me to see people like Eric Margulies like fall for the anti-Russian propaganda there. I'm like, come on. Why would the KGB, which should be called the FSB, but why would Russian intelligence assassinate a low-level mobster with a radioactive poison when they could just shoot him, stab him, throw him out a window, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you use like an $11 million highly traceable radioactive poison? Like, obviously that's not what happened. He botched a smuggling operation and OD'd on what he was carrying. That's what happened.
That's what I gathered from all the evidence. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, I wrote a big paper about it. But he was – that polonium was traced back to the residences and businesses of Boris Berezovsky, who Litvinenko was working for, because he was aiding Chechen terrorists. But Litvinenko was responsible for, as an informant also, on a lot of mob syndicate guys, eight bosses, in fact, who are doing this real estate scam in Spain, very similar to what Meyer Lansky did in Florida during the housing boom in Florida after the air conditioner was invented. You know, they all start moving south, all the snowbirds. Well, they were doing this scam, and so he owed a lot of people a lot of money, which is why I personally think he was willing to try and smuggle the polonium. What I'm interested in is what was the ultimate aim of that once they had that stuff in the UK? What were they planning on doing with it? But Berezovsky concocts this huge conspiracy story, and he's got the money to do it because he's a billionaire, saying, oh, Putin did it. He's trying to poison us with polonium, which made no sense. But the media all jumped on it anyway. And why wouldn't he just shoot him? Like, it doesn't make any sense. He has this deathbed confession solely to one other mafia gun. You know, they create this story, but it wasn't the first time he did that. When he killed this TV personality from ORT, which was like the Channel 1 of Russia back then, and he definitely had a hit on him because first he had hired this guy, Dmitry something, I forget his name, but to do the job, but that guy got arrested for something else the following day and just said everything that happened. And then he was witnessed by two cops on top of that, bribing this guy to kill the ORT personality. And so he's arrested, but then someone else did it, shot him in front of his house. And guess who takes over ORT? Boris Berezovsky does. And he told Yeltsin this big tale, oh, I've been set up. It's a big conspiracy by the Kaczynski group, my rivals. And Yeltsin was so paranoid that he knew that Boris was going to give him positive press. So, I mean, the press in Russia had always been owned by the state, you know. And so he thought, well, he's going to give me the positive press. He knew it was a conspiracy, but he knew it wasn't a conspiracy. I mean, he knew he had killed him, but they just went with that anyway. So he was such a drunk and in and out of the hospital and office that really Yegor Gaidar was controlling the country as the prime minister, and he was totally in bed with these oligarchs. But anyway, that kind of model is, I think, easier to understand by looking at Africa, because it happens over and over again and on a smaller scale. Because like if a small country like Zambia or Zambia, if you want to just look at, say, the copper mining or something, you can see all the corruption. They don't even really bother trying to hide it. And all you have to do is take that template, and that could have been Bolivia, that could have been Honduras, it could have been the Soviet Union. They're doing the same thing all the time, and it's usually the same individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a global syndicate, and intelligence agencies are totally in bed. I mean, United Fruit, which was so involved in so many Latin coups, was their board of directors membership overlapped with the CIA, with the Dulles brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the Dulles brothers, but that's the most recognizable names, I think.
Yeah, Sullivan Cromwell represented all these corporations that benefited from CIA operations. So, you know, the connection is there for all to see.
Yeah, well, Alan Dulles was on the board, too.
Yeah. And often if you focus on whether it's, if you were to simply do a show on Mark Rich or a show on the Dulles brothers or the show on, some of these figures.
I should probably do a Mark Rich film.
Yeah.
Because he's such an interesting character. I mean, he's a total bastard, but he's a very interesting historical person.
Mm-hmm. But you mean the connection between bankers and, you know, weaponized finance, Wall Street and international geopolitics and the CIA, the connections are pretty well spelled out if you just do, you know, cursory research. And I don't think you have to be too.
He's got Glencore, this robbing Africa blind. He's got all these crimes he did for the Israelis. And then he's tied in with the Clinton government. It's just, he's everywhere. And he was even involved with Boris Berezovsky and Rupert Murdoch. Mm-hmm. Mark, a young Mark Rich, he was like their protege. So that guy is such a central figure in so many major events in the last few decades. It would be good to make a film about his life.
And what's important, you mentioned Rupert Murdoch and the news, Rupert Murdoch and the News Corp, Corporation, News Corp, and that's the intersection between.
He owns Fox News and he owns Sky News.
Sky News, and same with General Electric and NBC, and whether it's the Disney Corporation and ABC and all this stuff. So the corporations that are benefiting from neocolonialism ultimately are also controlling the information that's coming out of these areas and the spin that's put on these civil wars. Or so you never really get a full picture, or you get a very skewed picture of the disruption or instability in the Ukraine or in Latin America or in Africa.
Oh, yeah, you know. Good example. They've been lying about Ukraine from day one. Mm-hmm. They've been lying about Syria from day one. We still haven't had any honest reporting on how those conflicts began. And they're both pretty similar because it starts with the sniper fire in both cases of Syria and Ukraine. And, I had Eva Bartlett on who very elegantly explained what happened in Syria. And I think Doug Valentine and I went over what happened in Ukraine. Almost exactly the same tactics were used. And then Crimea was returned to Russia. And they act like it was stolen. I said, it was originally Russian, and people there speak Russian, and the government was trying to ban the Russian language. So they voted on a referendum to leave. Plus, they don't want to be part of a country that's already 15 billion euros in debt. But how does it get so deep? How do you, when you're a billion euros in debt, you should stop, right? Mm-hmm. How did it get to 15? But that's the whole point, because mm-hmm. they want control of all the assets and resources, and Ukraine is a physical gateway of pipelines, so that's very important for that. And I feel bad for the Ukraine. I mean, they already had Holodomor. They've been just caught in this tug of war between the West and the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
For many, many decades.
But that area is a good example of this low-intensity conflict and economic warfare that the West wages as neocolonialism. You go in, you said you mentioned the snipers, you go in. Of course, this raises the specter of...
Before that happened, that Monsanto went into Ukraine and was buying grain elevators and all this, mm-hmm. this problem.
Yeah.
Ahead of the conflict. Spent an enormous amount of money doing it as if they knew a crisis was coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's Monsanto.
And that's controlling the food, which gets into Henry Kissinger's National Security Study Memorandum 200 in 1974, which controlling the food was considered as important, if not more important, than controlling energy. Yeah. And that's weaponizing energy, weaponizing food in a way to control the world, particularly target the third world, the developing world, because they saw the fertility rates as a threat, and which means you have to wage genocide. That memorandum advocated genocide. It called for the doubling of the death rate between 1974 before the year 2000 in order to stabilize population, and because the growing population would threaten demand for the resources, access to the resources that at prices that the mega corporations deemed fair, cheap. But this gets into this whole worldview,
they want it. Well, it's also about control, because they want to have a slightly excessive population so they have excessive labor and keep the labor cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want too many people either. And a lot of these people, you have to understand, like, Kissinger and the people from the 60s and 70s, etc., were extremely racist as well. Mm-hmm. Like, there were eugenics programs. I'm sure you know about the sterilization of Native Americans and
mm-hmm.
that was happening in the 1970s, right? The Family Planning Act and things like this, where really wanted to wipe these people out.
And you also have, I think for the better part in the 20s, you had the Rockefeller Foundation funding all types of research into contraceptives and eugenics. The Planned Parenthood, of course, was a beneficiary of the Rockefeller Foundation, which actually targeted particularly non-whites, colored people. But even
I don't know why it's called Planned Parenthood.
Yes, that's
because
always,
that means you're planning to become a parent.
Well, it's always Orwellian. And that's
it's the opposite. And I'm personally not against abortion, but. You can't say you're Planned Parenthood if you're going to all you really do is plan for paying for abortions. You don't have any postnatal care? Like, what? How are you going to help them once they
have
the child?
It's always been the thing. It's just like they call it, you know, when you run an abortion mill, it's a reproductive health clinic. It's nothing about reproduction.
It's the exact opposite of what it does. I mean, you should be helping people, brand new parents, but what they help you do is prevent you from becoming a parent. Mm-hmm. And that's very apparent.
They have a contempt for human life, ultimately. You mentioned the sterilization programs. Of course, we had the examples of the Rockefellers in Puerto Rico, where their program, I think, by estimates of the Puerto Rican Health Department, 35% of all women in Puerto Rico were sterilized not against their will, but they were unwittingly sterilized. They were, you know, kind of drawn into these modernized hospitals. And look, it's modern.
They lied to say this is for your vaccination or something.
They did that with Mexico and also recently in Kenya, where a tetanus vaccination was laced with a hormone which causes you to reject sperm, causes miscarriages. And this was discovered by, I think, La Leche League, which is a Catholic outfit, which wondered why tetanus shots were being focused on women ages from 14 to 45. Ages 14 to 45, and they was exposed that this tetanus shot, this vaccination program, was really a population control program. And no one's ever prosecuted for this, because this bureaucracy, it's the World Health Organization or it's the World Bank doing this. No individuals actually do this, by the way.
Well, that same Family Planning Act, they were taking Aryan babies mm-hmm. from their mothers and telling the mother the baby died. And then off and giving them to wealthy parents who are willing to adopt them and telling them the mother died.
Yeah.
Right? Told the mother the baby died, told the people adopting the baby the mother died, and selling these babies. And Ric Flair, the wrestler, the pro wrestler, was one of these babies. He got sent to this wealthy family in Ohio. He was told his North Carolinian parents or his mother had died and didn't have a father. But of course she didn't die. And he, because of his, you know, rise to wealth and everything, was able to find his real mom eventually. And he wrote about it in his biography. But Ric Flair was a product of this. Was stolen from his real natural parent and given to these other family who raised him and everything. But that's disgusting. And it was all for money.
Yeah, there's a did you see the movie, the Casey Affleck movie, Gone Baby Gone?
I have not.
It kind of touches on this. And what happens is there's this girl that goes missing, a little girl that goes missing, and her mother is a single mother, a poor mother living in South Boston. And her mother is kind of trashy. She's a party animal. She's just kind of neglecting her child, but nothing in a way that's in the actionable. It's just sad, you know, as you see many people do. And the girl goes missing, and this guy, Casey Affleck, plays a private investigator who starts investigating it. And I guess I'm going to spoil the movie for you, aren't I?
Spoiling it for everybody.
But it involves that justification that the girl gets kidnapped, and people who think they're better of this girl, think they're better than this woman who's not really raising their girl in an appropriate way, have the right to steal the kid for the child's benefit. And in this movie, he kind of cracks the case and exposes it and causes a lot of relatively high-level people to get caught in this kidnapping scheme. But the rationalization is that the mother isn't raising the kid properly. And Casey Affleck's character says, you can't do this. You know, you can't think you're either better than this poor woman to steal her kid because you think you're better. And throughout this movie, there's a rationalization for kidnapping because of this, but it's the same type of mentality. but once you...
I'll tell you something else about adoption that's not a... Well, I'll let people decide whether it's a scandal or not. It's sort of blurry, but a friend of mine's brother was adopting his second child. I think it's great. Like, all right, they don't want to live in foster care. You want a child. It's a win-win mm-hmm. situation. But I was he was saying that she asked him a tax question, and he said, I don't know. I haven't paid taxes because I adopted. Right? So mm-hmm. apparently the tax incentive, if you adopt a child, you won't have to pay your income taxes or anything. And then I started thinking about all these celebrities in the trend of all, like Angelina Jolie and all these people. I'm not saying this is that person's reason, but it is odd that once that law went into place, that suddenly it became very trendy to adopt children and about one every 2 years. Because if you're making millions of dollars, that's a lot of money you're giving the government. But if you adopt a child, which is good to adopt a child anyway, it costs way less than a few million dollars to raise a child. So,
but these are these perverse incentives that are created by these. You know,
yeah, it's weird. And it's like, well, I hope they really care for those children, because it would be horrible to adopt somebody just for the purpose of dodging taxes and to not really love them or have wanted a child so badly, like other families who adopt children.
Yeah, well, the reason why I mentioned that movie Gone Baby Gone got my attention, because I saw it years ago, but subsequent developments started making me think, particularly about the abuses that are occurring at various child protective services. And these agencies, in many respects, have been co-opted and have been more or less become a kidnapping or human trafficking operations. There is the case of Georgia State Senator Nancy Schaefer, and she died in 2010 in a reported murder-suicide, killed by her husband. And she was investigating the CPS and its involvement in child trafficking. CPS cases were paid bonuses for kids who were removed from families and then subsequently adopted out of foster care.
And I read through her case when I made that video about the how much bigger it is than the Pizzagate video.
So you're familiar with it, okay?
Yeah, I am.
So I mean that. So you're thinking if you so, I mean if you're involved in child trafficking, organized pedophilia, child abuse, ritualistic child abuse, and these things, and you need children, and you want a children of a certain type, there's no better way than to use your child protective services, who under certain pretexts can build a case to kidnap a kid from a family. Family may not have the resources to fight legally, and then put them in the foster care where they can be, well, drugged and abused more frequently than otherwise is the case, and then be sold off. And there's also a federal program that actually pays the state agencies money to more or less create the incentive to do that, just that. It's all done under the pretext of, you know, helping the children, of course.
But they won't pay to investigate it when it's abusive.
But then she dies.
They usually side with them.
Yeah.
Like some cases in Florida that she was looking at. It's almost impossible to have the right thing be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, the child will be sent back to the abuser.
But
that
that's
stuff bothers me. But that's what Mark Rich and Pincus Green were involved in too. They had an international ring.
And the point is, and you made the case earlier, when we were talking earlier in our conversation about, you know, war zones. If you foment civil wars, destabilize areas, depress economies, you create desperate situations where the men deal drugs and the women sell their bodies and sell the children off. There is this case. I was talking to George Webb, the researcher who has this series of interviews on videos on YouTube, investigating the Clinton Foundation and its relation to DynCorp and Haiti and around the world, the exploitation involved in human trafficking. DynCorp
was caught raping their own employees, and
yeah,
there's a lot of little Iraqi children, girls, and also some boys that are in Saudi Arabia right now, mm-hmm. as young as six, that would go out and dance. You know, like auctioning off the children because they're starving to death, and their families are like, well, better to live with these rich people and live than die. You have to think 800,000 people starved to death during the sanctions between the two wars, right? And after the invasion, people are doing anything to try and ensure their children's survival, and they become sex slaves in some cases. In other cases, they might become, if they're lucky, a maid or something like that, just a regular slave.
There's a business model here, I think, where if you immiserate a people, you can exploit them greater. And if you have someone else, outside parties, if you can externalize your costs through the Department of Defense, through Blackwater or Academy or through Triple Canopy or DynCorp, and go in and destabilize this area, then you can come in and buy everything on
the cheap. You got Z. I remember Blackwater was Z for a while.
Yeah, Z. but the point is here, again, he made this case creating this Digicel program where they're giving free cell phones to Haitians, and this involved micro-lending and usury.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. You can take the individual as an example or a nation. If you burden them with extreme debt, you can force them into a situation where they have to liquidate their assets to pay the interest. And this microlending for sewing machines apparently is a program designed to, again, burden these people down with debt under the pretext of giving them economic opportunity. And pretty soon they find themselves putting their kids to work to pay the interest on the debt, and also to possibly sell their kids off or to sell organs to pay the debt off. And this occurred in India. I think Carlos Slim, communications mogul, I think he's Mexican, but I think he originally comes from the Levant. But he's working with this Irish billionaire for this program that's designed, if you look at it, it's almost designed to, again, to drown these people in debt in order to exploit them, either through the labor or literally through their organs, or selling their children off.
In Brazil, they used to rent them their mining equipment. So not only did you have to go into the mines, your little pickaxe or whatever, you would have to rent it for the day, and that would come out of your cost. It's so disgusting.
Yeah, that's the old company store model.
Yeah, the company store model that the Union Army started after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. And that gets into the Ludlow Massacre and the Rockefellers, and then the formation of the Rockefeller Foundation as a PR attempt, and the foundations were used to, under the cover of philanthropy, they were able to take over, cultural institutions, educational institutions.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Rockefellers basically, like during the League of Nations that the U.S. didn't want a part of, the Rockefellers just set up their own little business representation and became sort of the shadow U.S. representative to the League.
Yeah, and that's what the Council on Foreign Relations was all about, and also the Royal Institute of International Affairs just kind of grew out of the same model. This is the...
Well, the CFR was more like the place is like the post-frat fraternity or the post-college fraternity. It's kind of like, mm-hmm, where all these criminals sort of retire and join the board.
Yeah.
The fellowship stuff they do, and like the Aspen's Institute's another one of those.
And another example is you can get pinpoint on individuals like George P. Schultz. There's George Pratt Schultz, the former Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan. He also came out of, I think it was Bechtel, this huge contractor. Mm-hmm.
The biggest. They got more than Halliburton or any of them.
But the name Pratt, there's also Pratt House, the CFR. He comes from that line.
I mean, Paul Nitze they named a section of the Aspen Institute after him. He was from Operation Northwoods. All these neocons. Oh, I forgot to say something earlier. So when you were talking about depopulation, as recent as the early 2000s, PNAC was writing papers about racially specific bioweapons.
Yeah.
If you remember that from Rebuilding America's Defenses, they're probably their magnus opus of all the papers they wrote. It should really bother everyone that not only did they think that was okay to find racially specific bioweapons, but they felt like it would be okay to publish such a thing and not worry about it at all. And they were right, because nothing happened. Like, PNAC wrote that. The Weekly Standard had it published. The PNAC website had it published forever. And I know Jonestown had everybody reading the line about New Pearl Harbor all day. But if you actually sat down and read the document, they're talking about racially specific bioweapons. And the Israelis were testing things on Palestinian prisoners and trying to come up with some sort of biological weapon against Arabs. Ugh. That happened. That's not from the 70s or anything. That was early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
So, all I mean, I'm in jail.
Well, yeah, that's the. But again, this gets back to a certain worldview that's been pervasive, I think, since, I guess you could go back to this maybe the 17th, 16th century. I think
the royals had that point of view that kind of. Yeah. The way they'd breed dogs and stuff, and for catching fox, and this idea of this sort of eugenics, but not even a lofty aim, delusional, but nah, it was just to control the plebs, the hoi polloi. Yeah. That's all.
This notion, I think, it was the when Magellan circumnavigated the globe. Professor Prouty talks about this in his book about JFK. How once the world was commonly understood to be a sphere, understood to be finite, and then it was sort of a scramble for those resources and controlling real estate. It's important to remember that people like George Washington, they were surveyors. They always coveted land, right?
True. Well, you have that, and then your second phase, I guess, would be the advent of nuclear weapons. And that's when they realized, all right, we got to use proxy forces. Yeah, so the CIA had set up all these madrasas, which are fostering religious fanaticism for Islam. And, of course, they backed the Zionist Jewish wing also. Mm-hmm. To use them as proxy forces. And that's been the model since the advent of the nuclear bomb. And that's what's happening in Syria. All these mercenaries.
Yeah, the fact, you know, that ISIS is obviously, if you look at it, it's backed by the Gulf states, which are, you know, proxies of Anglo-Americans.
Did you see the conference today? Did you see any of that? Saudi Arabia was talking about giving the rebels, a.k.a. terrorist mercenaries, anti-aircraft weapons.
That's like Afghanistan, isn't it? The Stinger missiles.
That's exactly what happened there, and that's what defeated the Soviets. They gave the terrorists anti-aircraft weapons, and they ended up creating the Taliban, which came back to bite them in the butt. But of course, that was the plan. Mm-hmm. Come hit us.
And you create this misery in Syria or in Libya, and you create this diaspora into Europe, which destabilizes Europe, which might help the dollar against the euro. That might be one element to it. But also, you create a lot of refugees. Among those refugees are going to be girls and children that can be exploited in the human trafficking market.
Yes, and that's something
for sex or for organs, yeah.
Missing pieces of the puzzle for a lot of people as they see the refugees, and they're worried about, oh, some small fraction of these refugees could be ISIS terrorists, and they're going to blow up or run into people with a car in France. And I'm like, yeah, but what about this huge swath of poor people who are going to be used for prostitution and, you know, the bad kind, not willing lately or anything. And that includes child prostitution too. And all the bad things that come from warfare. I mean, that's the side effects, and of course, narcotics trafficking, etc. People do anything for a buck when they have nothing to eat. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they can get in there and suck off social programs eventually. But look at it. I mean, you're talking about people living in tents and waiting, and of course, there's prostitution. Of course, there's narcotics. Of course, there's going to be crime. Like, what do you expect was going to happen?
And I was talking to George Webb about it. He was saying that what happens is the children, the girls or the children that are considered attractive are sold to different markets. The ones that are considered less attractive might go down to Haiti and service UN soldiers in Haiti.
Yeah, you're going to be.
That's what DynCorp is doing. And DynCorp was caught doing that.
DynCorp was drugging their own female employees and gang raping them, at least one case of that. Like,
jeez. Here's a good trick. Your example of how this neocolonialism works, this is written by Fletcher Prouty. He goes, when oil is found in the Middle East, it is controlled by the petroleum companies. When gold is found in South Africa, it is controlled by corporate mining interests. And if such things of value cannot be controlled by direct colonization, they are controlled by an equally powerful and oppressive economic force called the World Bank or International Monetary Fund. In the process, genocide is practiced regularly to limit excesses and to preserve the earth for the fittest. So this is this worldview and how they rationalize this stuff. The fact that you can exploit people this badly or spread misery around, because the misery itself is part of the business model.
They kind of believe in this social Darwinism. Mm-hmm. And it's like, look, you're not elite or anything. If you were put in their position, you'd be the one starving and stuff. You're not any smarter or anything like that. You just happen to be born on the right side, you know. Like, it's not hard to print money. It doesn't take any elite intellect or anything to shoot people. It's just you're on the side that has guns. You know, it could have been anyone. Mm-hmm. The older I get, and the more I look at people with wealth and not. Sometimes it's on merit, and sometimes it isn't. A lot of it's just about who you know. That's just how it is. It's that simple. The differences between most people aren't that great. It's just about, you know, having the right family or getting the right connection. Even more than education, right? More than your IQ, more than your abilities, more than any other factor is who you know. That's the biggest thing in your life.
Your wealth begets power, and power then begets more wealth, and that's how it works. You leverage your wealth politically.
I've made a lot of money for people by telling them what stocks to buy, but I couldn't buy them myself because I don't have the initial capital. It's like, if your only goal is to make money and you don't have any morals, then buy some Halliburton before the Iraq War, you know, get some good, because yes, it will go up.
Well, that's the kind of ethics that are promoted in business schools, and also the whole notion of, I guess, the corporation, which.
Yeah, it's sort of an amorality. It's sort of, whatever, any profits. But, you know, that's starting to change, and because it changes as social consciousness changes. Businesses will change with that because they have to respond to that. The guy that made 5-Hour Energy gives away like 90% of his wealth. I mean, that's rare, but it happens. I think long term, that's what will last also, though. As people see that, you're starting to see some of the more corrupt places are already facing boycotts and divestment. And that will always plague them, and it will grow as the internet grows, because people who are socially conscious can vote with their dollars and decide not to participate in companies that are, you know, using slave labor in China or what have you.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's the key there is understanding how this works, because a lot of people will look at sweatshops and go, well, that's a stage of development, and otherwise these people will be unemployed. So actually they're benefiting from this, because it's just a company going down there and tapping a large labor source. And strictly speaking, there's nothing wrong with that. The only problem is that large labor source. At least they have a job. And otherwise,
because that's not how it is. They would not otherwise be unemployed. They would have been employed.
They would have been on their farm. Or they would have been
they could be doing what they're doing now, just with a fair wage.
But you can. There's a wage. I mean, there is a science to coercion, and there's ways you can narrow someone's opportunities or alternatives to make it seem like they're engaging in a voluntary contract, when indeed they are not, because a generation or two before they were thrown off their ancestral homelands and forced into the cities and became idle labor that the multinationals could come in and exploit.
And like what NAFTA did, the agrarian society.
Exactly, and in Mexico. And then we're left to deal with the immigration problem. And then
we also have welfare subsidizing extremely low wages, so that somebody might actually have a job and still not earn enough money, so that they also collect welfare, even though they're working some.
Yeah, Walmart does that.
The wages, like Walmart does. And Walmart benefits from volume discount purchases on, like, say, food, which is subsidized by the government. The agribusiness is getting greatly directly from the state. So it's the state involvement that screws everything up, of course. But you have that happen.
And I think we've mentioned this before, is a lot of these large corporations are capitalized largely through the international drug trade. And so they grow larger and benefit from the black markets in ways that most people aren't even aware of. A good example would be there's a reason why Dick Grasso, I think Mike Rubert talked about this, went down and tried to get the FARC guerrillas to invest in Wall Street. And they said no. Then that's when Operation Columbia went into effect, because they weren't cooperating with New York. But there's always been, there's always been a connection between the banking houses and the international drug trade. The fact much
New the York and then later Miami were more favored to the Cali cartel.
Yeah,
but it's just like, that one. That's kind of like Richard Black.
It's in your face.
Richard Black said this about Syria. He says sometimes Ar-Al al-Sham and al-Nusra will fight with each other, and it's kind of like competing drug cartels, but. At the end of the day, the product and the purpose are all the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they fight with each other, but none of them have the Syrian people's interests at heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What happens there? You mentioned what happened with Mexico and NAFTA, and you've mentioned subsidized agriculture in the U.S. destabilizes agriculture.
It does seem like NAFTA is going to be renegotiated, though.
Yeah. Well, maybe because it's had such a devastating effect on both economies.
Yeah, the damage has been done. It really didn't help anybody. I mean, other than McGag.
Yeah, but yeah, that's what it was all about. Companies
on the border benefiting from under the table labor. But again, like if you look at these companies, if they didn't have to pay for the health insurance of all their employees, and that wouldn't be so high if it wasn't for government intervention either. Mm-hmm. You know, all those costs, if you cut all that out, they could pay them a lot more in wages. And even if they didn't, if they just expanded their business, then they would have more jobs available. Like the amount of money that the government is eating in taxes and forcing employers to pay for overpriced health care. If it wasn't overpriced, it wouldn't matter, but it is. Mm-hmm. And it's overpriced because of protectionist regulations that won't allow market competition. Like if the government would end all these practices, the market works. It was working before they put these things in place. And they wonder why. Well, how come I can't buy insurance across state lines? And, you know, people talk about it. Trump talked about it. Hasn't done it yet, though. They need to deregulate those bad regulations. And they need to get rid of these bad trade deals. But the establishment has never had any interest in doing that.
No, because each time you regulate your regulation, you're stepping on someone's toes. Even once they're in return, you know. The reason why these insurance wrote Obamacare, literally wrote it. So it wasn't like the senator's going to pay his plan, let's devise his plan, it's written for the benefit of insurance companies. That's all for their sake, because everyone's premium skyrocketed except for the very poor. And then it turns out they're not going to get decent health care anyway. It's all, you know, restriction.
Yeah, I did a show with Dr. Philip Caper about what you just said, and it's on ANC Report in the podcast section, and predicted all of that, what was going to happen. And then you have these Democrats so shocked that premiums are going up over 200%. I'm like, what do you think was going to happen when you make insurance mandatory and you don't allow market competition?
Mm-hmm.
You just gave away monopolies. Like, what did you expect?
And mandating that people buy health insurance, that's completely unconstitutional, despite what the Supreme Court says.
But they're like, well, in order to pay for this scheme, because a few people will benefit, like if you have, you know, some serious disease or something, but you could have Medicaid for it, I guess, but they got to get all these young, healthy people to be paying $200 or $300 a month. Yeah. They can't afford that. If you're young, you don't have hundreds of dollars a month to spend on stuff, especially if you have some part-time job or whatever.
Yeah, when I was 25, I didn't have health insurance. Didn't even think about it.
Yeah, well, it costs too much.
Yeah.
And you don't need it.
It's a bad deal.
But they're going to make you buy it so that it will offset the cost of someone who does need it. But it's like, but the person who does need it could pay for it on their own if the price wasn't so high. Like the underlying problem is the cost of procedures and drugs. It doesn't matter if your taxes pay for it or you pay for it or your employer pays for it or some combination between the three,
mm-hmm.
because the total cost is too high. And why is the cost too high? That's what you have to look at. Not, and you know, Sanders and them were looking around for a payroll tax or this and that to prop up overpriced industries when you could bring the price down. Like, why not lower the cost of living instead of raising the wages? Like, there are ways to bring it down on the other side so you don't have to go in search of new taxes or putting more burden on your employers and things, because they're just going to leave. He tried to model in Vermont, and the payroll tax was going to go up 11.5%.
Yeah.
People said no.
Well, the current medical system monopoly is a hard, like anything, like much of the economy, the global economy, it's a harvesting system. It's not based.
It's sick care. I mean, they realize they can make money off of sickness instead of health. And there's also patent abuse. And I totally support copyright when it's done right. But what they have is, we'll just change one isotope on this drug mm-hmm. and get a 15-year patent, and not allowing generics and not allowing competition to come in. And like, it's good to have the profit motive incentive for innovation and invention. But we also have time limits on that for a reason.
But there's a reason it's not considered a property right in the general sense. It's considered a grant to spur innovation in the arts. That's what the whole idea of a property rights in America was about. It was a time period to spur the innovation that was necessary, but wasn't there to create a grant in perpetuity. Because ultimately, then what you get is the stifling of creativity. You know, it's like the steam engine didn't but take off
until the government is stealing trade secrets and things.
That's a whole other thing. Yeah, they steal. Yeah.
Well, I mean, John Hinesio is a lawyer for. He's in the Microwire case. And he's got this other case for this this man that invented a type of canteen. It's all closed system and it prevents like biovirus attacks and stuff for the army. And they just robbed these people, stole the trade secrets, and sold it to a foreign government. So it's not even benefiting the United States. The Israelis ended up with it. And so why – and it's basically the government was trying to research the same thing on their own, failed because they're government. And this private company figured it out, what needed to be done to make microwire. The government was spying on a private company, stole their secrets, sold it to another government. Who now has built it and reaped all the profits?
It
and they're
like,
out
in total. That sounds like the Promise software.
Yeah, look up Microwire, just the Microwire case.
I have heard about the scandal about DOD using national security to steal and then seal patents from people. Yeah, that's a big scandal. Like another, and also the corporate espionage at the CIA. You know, which really is the CIA's primary mission is corporatism.
And gaining blackmail over these corporations. I mean, the Kushners were – I know we're going all over the map, but the Kushners now related to the president because Charles Kushner's son is Trump's son-in-law. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that set up a honey trap on Governor McGreevy, and he was the one that tried to set a honey trap up on his own sister, his husband, who was having none of it. And he ended up in jail. His CFO ended up in jail. But how many other honey traps – had he used? Mm-hmm. This is a New York real estate billionaire. It doesn't cost much to pay a hooker to bring someone to a hotel room and secretly film it, which is what he had done. How much more of that had gone on? And, you know, I know his son is not the same or anything, but it was that he owned the New York Observer, a newspaper, by the way, the Kushners did. Very first paper to report on anthrax in the United States. And he's letting an Israeli operative sleep with the governor of New Jersey. He got a six-figure salary. He was working in our nuclear power plant. Like, there's a lot there to dig into. But everybody during that scandal, all they did was focus on the gayness of the governor. And how strong he was to admit that he was homosexual because he had a wife, a female wife, right? Okay, he's gay. So what? I'm way more interested in the fact that he had a foreigner. And on his payroll, who is working in a very sensitive area of the United States in our nuclear facilities, and that they're tied to this real estate mogul who's now in jail. And, you know, that just the press wasn't interested in that. It's all there, but no one really put the dots together. You know? And so I thought, okay, with the Kushners being back, you know, again, because they're related to the man in the White House, maybe now we can talk about it. No. Even with all the fake news that's so anti-Trump, they don't want to get anything that really would mess with things.
Yeah, because they don't want to. Again, then you open up a can of worms, which threatens.
Because it would lead back to themselves.
Yeah, so they cover.
So they leave that one alone.
They do the gray propaganda. Yeah, so
They go after him for saying "grab pussy" or something like, "Oh, you offend me" or whatever, whatever. Nothing that would matter.
Well, it's a reason why, you know, Monica Lewinsky is a household word.
Right. It's the Lewinsky effect.
Yeah, but
you focus on this and you ignore him selling weapons to China and things like that.
But Terry Reid and Barry Seal, not many people know about, right? Which is the real story behind.
Yeah, and Terry Reid was still on the run, I think. He really blew the whistle on Barry Seal. Well, there's a lot more to Barry Seal than what Terry Reid uncovered, but that little section of that operation that was in MENA, Reed's book is available and tells you the whole thing and how they covered it up, the involvement of the Clintons and everything. But
Compromise is the book, yeah.
Yeah, it's called A Compromise. Yeah. Problem is, it's not a – it's a book. That's a problem. It's like Doug Valentine's books. You have to kind of – you have to have like a show like what we're doing, like a radio show or a podcast, in order to get enough people interested in to read the book or make a film and then so on. So, yeah. But, you know, Barry Seal got a little bit of fame because of, I think it was HBO, did something called Narcos. Was that HBO?
Yeah, yeah.
I live in Japan, so I don't know.
I think it's HBO, yeah.
With, you know, with Escobar and that
might
story.
Be Netflix, but go ahead.
Anyway, yeah. they talked a little bit about Barry Seal. And I was like, ooh, are they going to get into Barry Seal? And just sort of the surface of it. But it was better than nothing.
Well, a lot of these shows, yeah, like, just like Breaking Bad would cover one element of the drug trade and its involvement and how its money's laundered, but they never...
It's a dog whistle. It's yeah. like, this is as much as Hollywood would allow. You know, mm-hmm. There's a film called Triple Nine. That I can't believe they made this film and got away with it. It's called Triple, like, not 999, like triple the word triple and then the number 9, which is supposedly the police code for when a cop gets murdered. Mm-hmm. And interesting plot there. And they get into a lot of, like, actual mafia businesses that would work, too, and have worked and are happening. I couldn't believe they were telling people this stuff. I was pretty shocked.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's one of the things. I watched the first season of the show The Wire, and about I guess the counter narcotics branch of the Baltimore PD. It takes place in Baltimore, and they were talking about this one local drug lord that is being targeted, and they started going after it, and all of a sudden, the brass just wanted a certain street level arrest occurring so they could get their numbers up. But they didn't want to disrupt the drug trade because the drug trade itself was creating cash flow for political donations and also for this development plan for a local shopping mall that was going up as part of our local.
Oh, it's like Bernard Carrick.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of a revitalization program, and the guy in the movie, the guy who's running the counter narcotics operation, goes, you know, man, you go after drugs, man, and you start going after the money, and you realize the money goes everywhere, and that's when they shut everything down. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality of it. It's just once you get
that relates to what Terry Reid was uncovering too,
yeah. Because
that drug money was paying for pilots and stuff.
And he was a true believer. And when he found out that the drugs, at least according to history, he was a true believer in fighting communism.
He wanted to kill the commies and all that.
All that stuff. And then he found out about the drug trade, you know, all this drug being flown back after the weapons were, you found out the drugs were paying for the weapons. And
at the same time, was the just say no and this is your brain on drugs, mm-hmm. right? All those commercials in the 80s, all that was going on simultaneous to them facilitating narco money and trafficking to an extent, a greater extent than it had ever been. And you have, you know, like Ricky Ross didn't do all that by himself, you know. Like blame it all on him.
Yeah. It was Danielle Blandone or something, right? Danielle Blandone, who was sent to business school by the CIA.
Yep, and Gary Webb got into some of that, and mm-hmm. Others have gotten into it. The thing is, like, you need films. That's why I'm focusing on filmmaking. Like, I've written books, and I love reading books, but. Like, I've read a lot of books in the Civil War, for example. We talked about that. And I felt like, well, why don't I just say it in a video? And that's what reaches people nowadays. I mean, we have to be pragmatic. We can be snobby and stuff and say, why don't you just read? But a lot of people don't have time. And they're used to this video format because I feel like people, a lot of their life for a lot of people is in their car, going and coming back from work. And so that is a time where you can listen to a podcast like this and hear about this information. Mm-hmm. So it has to be in that kind of format. You can't read and drive. Japan, I'm lucky because I get to ride a train, so I can read books because mm-hmm. I don't drive. I just sit train and read. So I like that. But it's hard for me to hear a podcast because I need a battery and a headphone and all that, so book is better. But yeah. That's why we need to tackle these in all these formats, and that's why I like doing interviews with you, and that's why I do my own podcast too. Is I really believe that's the way we're going to be able to change things is by making films and doing like radio shows, podcasts. Not really radio anymore, are they?
It's podcast. Yeah. Well, podcast. You also find out if you're if you are a journalist and you really dig into these things, your career doesn't turn out too well.
Yeah, if you tell the truth, like if you really want to succeed in journalism, you got to toe the line. Like Hillary, we just found out, had like 65 reporters on her payroll.
Yeah. And they're meeting and strategizing. And, you know, mm-hmm. And that's just one level. If it goes deeper than that, I mean, go back in Project Operation Mockingbird. And
yeah. You know. Oh, well, that's in full effect. I mean, all you have to do is turn on television. Look at the reporting on the Iraq War or on Syria, on Libya, on anything. They just sit there and lie. Like Trump was right on that. Like you're fake news, but it's because they're attacking him mm-hmm. is why he said that, I think. But they are fake news. They lied about weapons of mass. All of them did. Fox did too. All of them. Fox was the worst during the Iraq War and worse than CNN even. They all lied. And they have these extremists left and right like MSNBC and Fox. So CNN can act like, look, we're the moderates in the middle. And it's BS. You're all liars. They all lie. They're all PR for the Pentagon. It's so obvious. They're all Zionists. Every single channel is Zionist. They're never going to say Palestine's under occupation or explain the very basics of any of the conflicts in the Middle East. And they don't even talk about the Congo at all. Like you mentioned, that's even lower than Palestine. It's like, well, whatever, Africans. So that's why another reason why I did my film on Africa, because no one talks about Africa. So,
or if there's something going – to the extent that people understand what's going on in Africa or their perception, it's because they're primitive, they're savages, and they don't know how to govern themselves, and there are too many of them, which is actually quite opposite given the size
of the country. But it's not politically correct for them to admit that they hold those beliefs, so they keep them secret. So nobody will come along and say, no, that's not because of that. This is why. So they just be like, oh, those poor Africans just don't know how or something.
Well, I mean, this isn't to say that – I mean, let's say Africa is has rich resources, is blessed with or cursed with resources, you could say. There isn't to say that there's a way there is an ethical way to interact with these with African people, to trade with them. There's nothing wrong with going in there and saying, here's our technology, hey, we can offer it's this good development. To do that. There's good to but do that. People don't do it though.
Happen, but you know, the solution is pretty simple. If the main thing of all of them, and there are paramilitary groups and all that, but the IMF and World Bank are the most destructive forces, in my opinion, of the three-pronged attack. If Africa were to get loans or nationalize the resource so they could pay for it themselves to build manufacturing so they could turn all those raw resources that they have into finished products and sell those for a lot more money than you can sell the raw resource – then they would get out of debt, and then they could pay, use that money, tax those businesses and profits, and use that to pay for schools and hospitals and roads and infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Instead, they're getting loans to build the infrastructure, which give you no return for a really long time, like school's not going to be good. And they get stuck in perpetual debt and forced to sell off their land and resources where they lease, you know, mines for 99 years to foreign companies who have all the profits. And even if you tax them, it's still not going to you. And so they need to lower taxes and focus on manufacturing. Instead, they do the opposite. They raise taxes and get more loans, and they just put them further and further in debt. You get loan number two to pay for loan number one. Like, how many times is Egypt going back to the IMF to roll over their loans? Always. It's annual.
Because they're not interested in the outside, the European or Western powers are not interested in development. They're interested in extraction, exploitation, and preventing development.
It's the outside and inside. Like, it's the Western powers and it's corrupt Egyptian government officials, because the West ensures that that style of government is what
will power.
If not, we'll kill you and replace you with your cousin. That's when the CIA will go into jackal mode.
Yeah. And that, because there's never a shortage of locals who are willing to sell out their own community for to be enriched. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the Opium Wars, right? When the British, you know, contacted certain Chinese people to deal with the opium, to reverse the trade imbalance there, and also to undermine, you know, Chinese society.
CIA did with the Phoenix program to Chinese traders in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. There's obviously huge black markets and food shortages and things. So Chinese would come in, let's say, selling rice very innocent, right? We're going to sell, since this town has been so decimated, we're going to bring rice in and sell it. CIA would come in and say, are you a suspect? You know, I think you're a communist sympathizer because you're selling rice. And you want to become an informant? You know, and they have to tell on somebody. They don't have anyone. They're not really part of anything. So they'll turn to them and say, well, you know what you could do is start selling these drugs instead when you go back with your rice and use that as your front, blah, blah, blah. And they are set up narcotic rings with the Chinese who they're supposedly fighting, you know, because it's communist. The whole thing, they do it. They would go in and they would get innocent merchants and say, what are you doing here? Oh, are you part of this insurgency? We think you are. And it's like, do you want to rot in jail or get killed, be tortured in a cage, or are you going to play along? And they would play along, of course.
Mm-hmm. That's what Doug Valentine talked about. Someone asked him about what was going on in Vietnam. And, you know, whether it's, you know, heroin, the arms industry. Obviously, it wasn't the domino effect. That was just an excuse. But he says, well, ultimately, I think what it was also, they wanted to go and fundamentally change Vietnamese society. They want to turn them into members of the, what they call the New World Order, or just turn them into workers and consumers. Whereas prior to American intervention, there is a sort of an agrarian, Asian society, self-sufficient in food. And if you go in and you bomb the hell out of the country in 20, 30 years, perhaps, these people will be willing to work in factories producing shirts and stuff, you know, for the markets westward. And that's precisely what happened.
They have a monarchy now, and that's exactly what they're doing. And you have a lot of Vietnamese now studying Japanese and English. Mm-hmm. I know some of the language schools here, half the students are from Vietnam, which is, you'd think it would be China or Korea or somewhere closer. No, they're half of them are from Vietnam. They realize you have to learn the language of the places with money, which is the United States and Japan and China.
Mm-hmm. And if this is all part of globalization, forced globalization. This isn't the interaction that would occur with, you know, with honest friendship and free trade.
Oh, this is not natural free trade at all.
No, it's not. It's never happened.
I mean, Indochina has been turned into just a cesspool of prostitutes and narcotics, and their currencies have been completely inflated. Like, people go down to Thailand, just that's what they do. They go on like sex vacations and stuff because the currency of a European country or Japan or South Korea or something is worth a lot of money. So they go to Indochina and they can buy people. They can live like kings. And it's not like they work harder than these people, as in many cases they don't work as hard as these people. It just doesn't matter how hard you work if you live in a place like that, because your block or whatever isn't worth anything. It doesn't matter how many hours you put in or how hard you study. You'll never make the same level of wealth as somebody doing the exact same labor as you in a country that has a currency that means something. And that's the saddest thing. This myth, like the harder you work, the more money you have. That's BS. I mean, you'll have more than other people in your own currency circle, but working harder does not mean you're going to be wealthier. Studying harder, there are people in Vietnam that speak three or four languages, they're really educated, they're still poor because they live in Vietnam or because they live in Thailand. Like, that's what people have to understand. Like, it's not fair. It's not based on your hard work, not always. And it's decisions that they had nothing to do with. You know, their government sold them out before they were even born. We have to change these things.
Yeah. Well, the currency itself is a form of wealth extraction, as opposed to being a wealth, you know, ways of storing wealth. It's the fiat dollar itself, particularly the debt-based fiat currencies, are a method of wealth extraction. So is the current banking system. So is the current medical system. So is the current tax system, unsurprisingly. But a lot of these systems have sort of a tapeworm effect on the economy. And they're designed to that certain effect because they're designed to give you a little bit of what you want so you stay in it, but not realizing
especially
that.
Medical in the United States, I think that's the number one reason for debt isn't from mortgages, it's from healthcare bills.
And I think our iatrogenic death, doctor by death by doctor, is the third leading cause of death in the United States.
So, I imagine eventually college loans are going to creep up there.
They are, because that's another way of debt is a weapon. As I was rewatching The Godfather 3, I hadn't seen it since I was in my early 20s, and a lot of it went over my head because I didn't know anything about P2 and the Vatican Bank and this, you know, the alleged assassination of the Pope and all that stuff. Like, but it never really
again movies made in the 70s.
Yeah. Now, The Godfather 3 isn't as good as the 1 and 2 as far as dramatic effect. The movie itself isn't as good, but it sort of ties the knot, puts the bow on it, sort of explaining these things. But
it goes up a level, though, because the level of corruption in the first couple, and I'm not going to give away the Godfather plots, but it's sort of your basic level mafia stuff.
Yeah.
And it really climbs the ladder in the third one.
But within The Godfather, I think you get an allegory of how the world really works. And one thing is that you could look at Don Corleone as you know, as a, well, as an oligarch, and or he has an
well, that to me, that whole series is based on very similar events that actually happened in New York.
Of course, yeah. And you have, you know, the Luciani, the heroin, and all that stuff. But, you know, the good example in the first one, you have them, of course, the drug trade, but also you have them using assets in the media to plant stories. And that's what the CIA does. You have them finding out that this guy Pauly was behind the alleged assassination attempt on the Don. They do that because they have assets in the phone company. You know, that's how they get all this information, you know, because they know someone from the other gang called to pay for him right outside his apartment or something. That's how they make these connections. You have the use of sex traps, and you've Senator Geary with the dead prostitute and these things. Okay, there we go. But in the third one, Michael Corleone is starting a foundation. You know, and he's going legit now. He's joined the big leagues, and he says to his sister, he goes, all my life I've been trying to become legit, climb the social ladder, and what I find is it's more corrupt the higher you go, you know. And that's he's now trying to join the ranks of the big boys.
It's like
big gangsters. Gotham.
People have watched the series Gotham. The higher up is the commissioners and all that are
the
worst
it gets. The worse it gets. And there's
biggest thieves and murderers are government.
Yeah, and there's this one guy in there who represents like a European P2 wing of I guess organized crime. And he's negotiating with Michael Corleone, and Corleone's Michael's nephew, who is the illegitimate son of Sonny, the character in there, and he's trying to get information on this other group for Michael, so he's pretending like he's negotiating. And
just turn this off now if you haven't seen the Godfather series. Yeah.
Sorry, you should have seen it by now if you're listening to this podcast. But he starts talking about finance and Sonny's illegitimate son. I forget the name of the character of his name, but
you know, if they haven't seen The Godfather yet, it's their fault.
Exactly.
They deserve it. No.
No. He goes, this is finance. I don't handle finance. He goes, finance is war. You don't understand. Finance is war. And he goes, politics.
You know, I did this math on the, you know, Trump always says we spent $6 trillion in the Middle East over the last 15 years. That is $1.4 million a minute.
Yeah. Because finance is war. Politics is knowing when to pull the trigger. You know, so or finance is a weapon. Finance is a weapon. Politics is knowing when to pull the trigger. And that's true. And that's what we're getting, you know, that's what we're seeing played throughout. I think the good example is the student loan or debt crisis, which they created by offering too many cheap loans to students. Is a way to make sure that when they graduate and they're saddled with debt, that they're compliant.
Plus, you know, plus the Department of Ed was making money off the spread between interest rates, since the government can borrow money a lot cheaper.
Yeah, and the schools love it because they get a lot of cheap money to expand and create their own little empires, and so, you know, so it's a big scam, and you know,
they were even using the schools as collection agencies on. In my book, The Separation of Business and State, I got into that because I feel like that's a hot topic that incoming students ought to know. And you could read just that chapter and then be well more aware and not get caught in that gambit.
Well, at some point, there's got to be a jubilee or end of this because the end is slavery. It's indebted slavery, and that's what it's designed to do.
Kids, they graduate with the equivalent of a mortgage, only they don't have a house.
Yep. Yeah,
and they think, oh well, you know, of course, you'd rather go to college than not, because you'd rather get that education than not. But it does have a price tag to where it is not worth that much more. Like, let's say it cost $1 million to go to college. Like, be better to just keep the $1 million, you know?
Yes.
There's a point where it's like, well, it's not worth the price. And they think it's worth any price.
Well, they say you can't put a price on a good education. Well, that's funny. They do.
You do and you can.
They do and they can't.
If they want to average, people are earning this much more to graduate. I'm like, that's because a few of them went on to become billionaires. You got to wipe out the outliers. Man, they ought to teach basic statistics in high school. Instead of it really bothers me because you have a lot of children who are – not children, whatever, young people who are they excel in math. And they'll be doing calculus in high school. I'm like, why are they doing calculus? Like, well, I'm doing pre-cal, and I'm doing calculus. I'm like, that's nice. Have you had statistics? No. Well, that's useful math. That's what you need to know. Go towards the path of statistics and do calculus if you're going to be involved in a science that needs calculus. Otherwise, learn statistics because that's good for your daily life. And not having a large population that does understand statistics is why you can lie to them with statistics and say, well, like the wage gap BS. The reason people fall for that and get all bent out of shape is because they don't understand statistics. If you did, you would understand that women are not paid less than men for the same work. They earn less on average. But they don't work as much on average. It's simple.
They do other things. They have other priorities, and that's going to reflect in these averages,
you know,
and if you were to try to,
there's nothing wrong with the other choices either.
Yeah.
But the idea that all groups are going to have equal outcome in anything is ridiculous. I mean, you're never going to have it exactly the same number of male nurses as female, or female engineers as male, or racial categories or age categories or whatever. It's never going to be exactly the same in everything. So the odds of that happening, of every industry being exactly even in every single kind of category, are virtually zero.
And ultimately, there's nothing ultimately wrong with these differences. Because if you really want to celebrate diversity, you know.
Yeah, I mean, people need to understand most industries are still the apprenticeship model. Even though we have public schools and everything, most people do a business similar to their parents. Not everybody, but, you know, that's all. Because you know why? Because they know about it. So they do it. It's nothing about race or anything like that. It's like people in this area have these skills because there are a lot of other people in that area who already have those skills to learn from. It's that simple. People who live on the coast get in the hotel industry, let's say in Hawaii, because that's the biggest industry around. And so, oh, look at all these Hawaiians and all that. Well, what do you think they're going to do? What do you expect them to do? Milk farm? Like, they live in the mountains. And people don't look at these common sense geographical explanations for outcome. And they're like, oh, there must be prejudice here or there. I find it to be very little prejudice and a lot more if you just looked at common sense, like, you know, even athletics and things like that. Well, you know, a lot of pro boxers are of certain ethnic groups. Well, that's because a lot of those same ethnic groups live in urban areas, which is almost exclusively where boxing gyms exist.
Yeah.
You know, yes.
And that changes because a while back it was Italians and Germans that were dominant in boxing. Then it became blacks and Hispanics. In the mid-century, blacks and Hispanics became dominant, and now I'm noticing a lot of Eastern Europeans in boxing.
Yeah. You know, well, because it's, you know, one for boxing in particular is a very rough sport.
Yes.
And so you look at it and go, well, I'll get X amount, but only if I'm the best, right? But you know who attracts? People with very little to lose. So it's always the poor. And so that's why you had the Irish and the Italians and blacks and Hispanics and Eastern Europeans, and because they're poor and it's a way out. And that, you know, and they're
you're always gonna have more blacks playing basketball than Asians.
In the U.S. you will, yeah.
Yeah, in the U.S. Yeah, we have in the U.S. NBA, rather, the NBA. Because it's the American
NBA.
That's
because, you know, basketball is very popular in the South, and the southern cities are like 30-40% black, so it's representative of the numbers. You're not going to have a lot of hockey players because that's a northern kind of sport. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of blacks live in the north, so it's not black. It's geographic. That's it.
And it's not necessarily a problem that needs to be remedied or helped, so to speak.
Yeah, it'll all flip around just like boxing did, golf did, tennis did. They all have time periods of different groups dominating this or that. Maybe Asians dominate ice skating. Well, it costs a lot of money to practice ice skating every day. So, it's not about natural athleticism. It's a lot of other factors. Like if you're going to be a professional skier, either you work at the ski place or you have a lot of money so you can go practice skiing every time. Like that's how it is. And people don't look at they don't even try to find other explanations for these kind of differences in outcome. They just think it must be prejudice because our culture now is wearing glasses that just see racism, sexism, whateverism everywhere, prejudice everywhere, because that gives you an opportunity to feel morally superior and virtue signal. And it's just disgusted me because that kind of collectivism only adds to the very same problems you're trying to prevent.
And there's also the presumption is that the natural state is equality, when actually the actual state is inequality and differences. And there are legitimate inequalities and there are illegitimate inequalities. Like, when you're dealing with privileges or laws that prevent people from entry, barring from entry, things like that. Or, macroeconomic policies or banking systems which cause distorted accumulation of wealth.
I mean, tribal nepotism. You look at certain niches in Hollywood or something where people hire each other. And that is based on prejudice sometimes. But most of it is just because, families do the same business as what they know. And that's the whole reason you get the same groups doing the same things is because that's who started doing it. Like Thomas Sowell talked about that. Like almost all the piano builders in Russia or anywhere were German because that's who'd always done it. And it didn't matter if they're in Germany or not. They had that skill. It's just something that's passed on usually from family. So it's not all nepotism. It's just more like that's what they're good at. Another group could come in and learn to trade and do it, but we don't generally randomly choose some trade we're not familiar with out of the blue. That can happen through the college system, but usually it's, they come out and stay in the safe waters,
Now, to close the interview out here, we started talking about neocolonialism, how it relates to drug trade, human trafficking, and these things. Ultimately, again, we're dealing here with a vision or a philosophy that rationalizes the exploitation of human beings. And
it's the world order that they want to preserve themselves on top. And that's another reason for the high taxes on the middle class is because that's the biggest threat to the upper class. I really hate it when people call them elite. They're not elite. They're elitist, but they're not elite. They're not superior. They're totally replaceable. Anyone can inherit their money and take their position.
But it get into some really, because people, let's say the average person out there who reads the New York Times, Washington Post, and watches network news, even some cable news, he may even fancy himself well informed. They're not going to be aware that such things can occur, because I think you did a video, an excruciating video detailing child trafficking and pornography and government agencies and these things. And some people, we've had these recent scandals. This Comet ping pong pizza thing here, so-called Pizzagate or Pedogate, but those familiar with the issue.
Yeah, that was a clever thing, Pizzagate, because there's a lot of disinformation in that too, like saying, the Podesta brothers kidnapped this girl in Spain. Mm-hmm. Actually, the police drawing is of one guy and the Podesta brothers are not in Spain at the time. So people see that and throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm like, if anything's getting all this attention all of a sudden, look another way, because there's plenty of pedophilia and all that does exist. They're so corrupt. And that video I made, and it's every institution in government. I mean, mm-hmm. the Park Service, like everybody. You can see my face in that video. I look like somebody just shot someone right in front of me. I was so distraught from researching that. It's really sickening. It really takes something out of you, and I don't ever want to delve into that again. That's my one video on it for like the next 3 years. I can't get back in. I felt so dark just even knowing about it. Mm-hmm. That and organ trafficking. That's like the worst thing.
The organ trafficking, and this is something that, again, I always thought it was the area of, I don't know, urban legend. You hear stories and all that. But if you look at the economics of it, and we're talking about, you know, wars, finance, neocolonialism, the exploitation of people. I mean, which
people sterilize people on purpose, gave people syphilis, and watched them die. You don't think they're going to steal liver?
Like, that's my point, exactly. And I've been following the research of George Webb, and he kind of explains it in a way. He admits that some of this is speculation, but it's informed speculation. And it's based on these inferences based on the evidence. And the fact, if you look at the operations down in Haiti, in Chicago, he mentioned it's happening domestically as well. But areas, if you follow the pattern of how the money's being spent in Haiti, how the hospitals, high-tech hospitals being built, resorts being built away from the earthquake areas, and how this Haiti can be, Haiti and also Syria, how you have all this labor that can be exploited, but also resources, and included in those resources would be the actual organs of these people. He says if you can extract an organ for a few thousand dollars in Syria or in Haiti, under the cover of a civil war or a natural disaster, and sell it for $100,000 in Europe or in America or in China, if you're doing these other things, selling kids off to the sex markets, you know, fomenting civil wars that would just destroy the lives of hundreds of thousands, of millions of people. Like
yeah.
Why wouldn't you
kill them anyway? Why would you not at least take an organ too?
Yeah.
Look at all the people they've starved to death. Look at all the people mm-hmm. they hit with MK-77 or white phosphorus is a more popular name.
Yeah.
All the napalm in Vietnam and, you know, the firebombing, the drone strikes, killing the thousands. Yeah.
And he says how this is done. It's done through outfits like DynCorp or Kraft International, perhaps. I mean, I'm a bit sued, allegedly. Or some of these mercenary groups or special forces guys who go private. And they're trained in the lethal arts. And it's also what happens is he explains how this can be done is some of the jackals, some of the hitmen, may even think they're targeting bad people. And how the people like Doctors Without Borders or some of these other NGOs are
White Helmets.
White Helmets. They're implicated is that there's doctors.
White Helmets is the civil group for Al Nusra Front.
Yeah, Al Nusra Front. Yeah, but the thing is, they'll kill somebody and they'll injure somebody, give a head wound or something, bring them into the hospital and say this person is dead now. You might as well just get their organs, and the doctors who extract the organs don't even know. They're just doing their job. They're trained to extract organs, and often they're just med students themselves. It's the extraction is the easy part. Apparently it's when you put them back in is the hard part. You know, the transplant's the hard part. But
Do you know who invented a new method of doing that was Charles Lindbergh?
Really?
It's something he's lesser known for, but he figured out a way of pumping oxygen and nutrients around the organ to help preserve it during transplantation. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and my point, of course, something like this can be great if it's done ethically and morally. But if you look at the way the market is being, the market's being created because you have these areas that are unnaturally destabilized or exploited because of a natural disaster or something, and go in and under the cover of philanthropy, like through the Clinton Foundation, where the Obama administration puts the Clinton Foundation in charge of relief operations in Haiti, and billions of dollars go into that area. And only a trickle gets to the people, and it's all siphoned off into development operations or just stolen.
Where did it go?
And there's no – and people like Charles Ortel, who's actually studied the Clinton Foundation. The Clinton Foundation itself has never had its paperwork in order. It's an illegal operation, and there's no prosecution. There's no way to go after that. The IRS is going after it.
Julie Bishop, who's the foreign minister in Australia – Netanyahu's going to meet her in a couple of days. We're protesting, but she'd been giving millions to the Clinton Foundation. I think it was 81 or 88 million mm-hmm. by the end of it. And they asked her about it. Oh, this is for the children in Haiti and da da da. And the moment Clinton lost, the amount went to zero. You weren't paying for influence? Somebody you no longer care about Haiti. Yeah, the Haitian children? Apparently not. They were definitely paying for influence. And now she's mm-hmm. just catering up to the Israelis. First Israeli prime minister to visit Australia, and it's going to be on Wednesday. And I hope they protest him. When Netanyahu lands, I hope they meet him with signs, etc. So, yeah, Julia Bishop's another snake in the grass. But mm-hmm. usually the Clinton Foundation was washing dirty money through Frank Kustra in Canada.
That's right. He's the producer, right?
He was just the middleman. He would he'd donate so the Clinton Foundation could say on the books this came from this philanthropist or whatever this Frank Kustra character. But Kustra was being paid by the Sauds and by Qatar and different foreign governments who are paying for influence. But the Clinton Foundation could not include those donations from Saudi Arabia and say, it's not from Saudi Arabia, it's from Canada, and it's from Frank Kustra.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just, cycling the money. He was cleaning the money for them. So even though we know that Clinton did take donations from Saudi Arabia and Qatar and so on, so a much larger portion that came from those countries was not counted as such because mm-hmm. it went through Kustra and outfits like that. So that, but they, they got lazy because usually there's three or four mediums for a good money laundering operation at least. And she was just using one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when someone feels invincible. This is all pre-WikiLeaks and all too.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even try to hide it.
And yet there's no prosecution as of yet.
Not yet.
It's all internet talk. It's all researchers and the legacy media, the mainstream media isn't even covering it. It's all, the alternative media.
It's true, but like I just said, Julie Bishop's went from 80 million to zero. So they fear the internet somewhat.
Yeah.
She doesn't have any influence anymore either, but
which explains the private server scandal, which is another violation of the law, these things, which, because obviously she wanted these things off the books, but the problem is if it's a private server, it's unsecure, it's not off the books because you can imagine multiple intelligence agencies are getting access to that information.
They have the dirt. And that was a little bit of a Lewinsky too, because to me, a much bigger leak was the fact that Clinton was admitting she knew Qatar and Saudi Arabia were clandestinely financing ISIS in Syria
mm-hmm.
and did nothing about it and said nothing to them, like knock it off or anything. And she's the head of the State Department. That, and Julian Assange said that too, that was the biggest leak, was that information. And yet the focus is on, all these emails that were deleted and scrubbed and all, and that, which is an issue, but it's kind of like the lesser problem. Like, oh, we'll put all the attention on this. Like, we'll put all the attention on the blowjob from Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Which, so we don't have to talk about Vince Foster or any of that. So
there was that email between Sid Blumenthal and Hillary Clinton, I think, regarding them talking about,
Blumenthal's father.
Exactly. Yeah. But, she's the one that wanted the State Department. Barack Obama said no, apparently. Then she put him there. I think she put him over there at the Clinton Foundation, I think, who I guess he was sitting on top of that server, I guess. But there's emails going back and forth about Libya and talking about, I think, the gold, $9 billion in gold that they intended to seize as part of the operation in Libya. So this was just going in like pirates. It's just in your face. They're talking about this. So,
the pirates of Tripoli.
Yeah.
They go way back.
And of course, then Libya leads into Syria with the Nusra Front and the Libyan fighting group.
A lot of the arms went from the surplus arms went in, not only into Syria, but also into Mali.
Yeah.
So remember the French invaded Mali? That was sort of a forgotten war.
That's right. Yeah.
And a lot of the weapons surplus from Libya and guards went into Mali, and that conflict spilled into there. And that was very lucrative in the French uranium interest in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So you remember the French were leading the charge in Libya. That's right, yeah. And then went into Mali. And so that the French interest in that and their own interest. The U.S. is always following Israeli interests.
Well, it was humanitarian. We have a responsibility to protect.
Oh, yeah, it's humanitarian, of course, is the new speaker. That's how a Democrat starts the war, on humanitarian. That's how they censor free speech and stuff, too. Oh, this is to go against bullies, or this is to protect LGBTQRSTUV, whatever.
Or fake news. You got to fight fake news.
Yeah, we got to fight. Again, it's just a pretext. And it's, yeah. But CNN is fake news. So I laugh at that stuff. I'm glad they're fighting with each other. I think that's the best when the crooks start turning on one another.
Yeah.
And it always happens. The villains can never gang up on Batman because they fight with each other too much. Because that's how dishonest people are. They can't trust each other.
Yeah, there was American intervention is always sold as sort of this noble cause. Have to go and save the benighted people of Africa or Latin America.
We're greeting the Kurds. We're getting women's suffrage in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's like the Navy's a global force for good. Apparently, that's what the Navy's for. So they run their ads, and I think there's Noam Chomsky who said he's controlled in his own way, I guess. But every once in a while he says something that's really good. He says, American intervention is there to secure America's fifth right. I guess he's talking about the four freedom, or fifth freedom. And I guess he's referring to the four freedoms spelled out by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But he says the fifth freedom is unquestionable access everywhere to the world's natural resources, because we covet the resources. Now he's putting it in nationalist terms, America, but really we're talking about America. We're talking about the American empire, we're talking about the global conglomerates.
Talking about multinational corporations that don't have any loyalty to a specific piece of dirt.
Yes.
It's just wherever their lobbies and parasites can control the management arms of corporate conglomerates, which we call governments.
It's governments, and the governments are their agents.
Yeah.
When you want to talk about, it's like that speech in Network by, when Ned Beatty says to Howard Beale, they're all in our nations. There are no countries. There's Exxon. There's IT&T. There's Union Carbide. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It's been that way since the man crawled out of the slime. that's his worldview. That's that, London, social Darwinist worldview that's spelled out in that speech. But that's how they view the world. It's a business, and under the bylaws of business and under the corporate charter, it's their obligation to have a return for their stockholders. And whatever they do in that endeavor is justified as long as they get a good return for the stockholders.
The best was in Monty Python, of course, where the British are there and they get taken over, and the name of the name of the American company is the Very Big American Corporation. Written on the wall behind them. If you see it, it says "Who?" And they turn around and it says the Very Big American Corporation. It's the name of the corporation.
That's great. The Very Big American Corporation.
And they're all like, "Oh no, not that."
What was that corporation that funded the destabilization of Russia? The American International Corporation, I think, right? Was it the American International that went in and funded the Bolsheviks?
Well, we've had a number of NGO umbrellas that helped destabilize Russia.
But I think this is back in 1919, 1917, and it's one of these untold stories of American intervention.
Oh, you mean during the First World War? Yeah. I was thinking recently.
I think it was the American International Corporation went in there. It was represented
even the Red Cross, the front.
Yeah, the Red Cross was a front, yeah. That was Hoover's operation over there, the food relief program, and going in there and destabilize it.
There's a humanitarian front again. Oh, look, it's the Red Cross.
Yeah.
So nowadays, it's, religious schools, language schools, things that seem so innocent, but and could be.
They could be, yeah. Because
UNICEF. Look, we're bringing food. No, you bring guns to rebels. Thomas Mountain witnessed that happening.
I was reading his blog. Reading up his blog, he's a good source for that. But for Africa.
Oh yeah.
But again,
I call him more, but it costs so much to call Eritrea from Japan.
Yeah, there's no.
It's no Skype.
Yeah, it's you're taking something. I mean, because there is something. I mean, I do think I'm a critic of Western imperialism, of the whole neocolonial thing and the whole colonial project in general. But I'm also not a cultural relativist, and mm-hmm. I do think that in a better world, in a more honest world, the European, the Western world, America, Europe, would have a lot to teach and help the world. In terms of development, and maybe
it's happened that way, yeah. But for the right reasons sometimes. Like free markets work.
Yeah.
Japan and South Korea are both shining examples of how a different society can adopt the Western model of business and outdo the Westerners.
Like yes.
Japan has more money than any country in Europe. South Korea is right up there with like Germany, I think. They're like the 11th biggest economy in the world. And that's only with 60 million people too. But the reason was they wanted a buffer zone against the Soviet Union, so they had lopsided trade with Japan, and because of North Korea, South Korea is allowed to prosper. But that free market model works. What doesn't work is neocolonialism. It's better to build things up like Germany and Japan and South Korea and trade with them and benefit from the fruits of their labor. It's nice having Samsung. It's nice having Sony and Panasonic and whatever. In the long run, it benefits the consumer, it benefits our standard of living, our way of life, et cetera, to have BMW and Toyota and so on. So building them up and having trading partners would be the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But this old model, because of this social Darwinistic philosophy, what they want to do in places like Zambia, which there's no reason Zambia couldn't be on at least the same level as like Morocco or Egypt or something, it is to oppress and enslave and rip the wealth. And, you know, yes, you get a little bit of copper money here and there, but if you were to build it up, you could have something like Singapore instead, you know, which is going to get so much more money in the long run. And it's a win-win for everybody. But they don't do that. They push it down. And that they need to realize it's kind of the right thing for the wrong reason. Like, hey, wage slavery is actually cheaper than slavery. Like better.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And it's better for the slave too. It's a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
I'm hoping they'll do the right thing for their own greedy interests kind of thing.
And yeah, that's what you're hoping for, yeah.
Be building people up because, yeah, Western philosophy and free markets and capitalism work. What doesn't work is this cronyism with government and imperialism. That's what has to die, is the imperialism and the government. We'll take the markets, fine. We'll take that, but we don't need the imperialism.
Yeah,
because that's no different than when the king had the serfs. You know, that's the model of that feudalistic society that they can no longer get away with. They'll just impose it on other areas, in which they have done.
Yeah, well, that imperial strategy was laid out by Brzezinski in The Grand Chessboard, where he just unabashedly calls for tributary states, domination, control, preventing the Eurasian landmass from developing, keeping it poor and destabilized.
He was actually mad at the other neocons because he said, you're boiling the frog too fast.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
why Sibel chose, I think, why she chose boiling frogs.
To yeah. The first, yeah. But this, basically what it is they'd rather control an impoverished, destabilized world than a wealthy, peaceful world that can actually live and, you know, actually live. We benefit from each other's trade and prosper. They'd rather have an enslaved, bitter,
they want people world. To shit on. They like having their sex vacations and stuff like
that's
that.
That's what
they
it
like
is.
They like exploiting people. They like abusing people. They're bad people.
Yeah, and this is
they I mean, love the power trip. They love being able to just own somebody. Just have enough money to make somebody do anything you want.
Yeah,
that's what they want. And you can't do that first world to first world because the person will just tell you to F off.
Yeah.
But you can do it to third world. And that's the just simple, maniacal, power-tripping, really psychopaths in most cases.
I mean, if Thailand wasn't poor, then Denny Hassett couldn't fly there and exploit kids. So
yeah. And there's no reason Thailand has to be like that.
Yeah.
They have really hardworking people. They have industry, and they are changing things now. But, you know, there's no reason they couldn't have the same model as other Asian nations that are very successful. Singapore's turned things around. Hong Kong's turned things around. Like, Japan and Korea surpassed any European country, like I said. That could happen. But, you know, people are conflating capitalism and imperialism as if one they're one of the same. And all the problems they have with capitalism are actually they have what they have problems with governments and government foreign policy, predatory loans, etc., which are not innate or intrinsic to capitalism. They're specific government policies.
Yeah, it's corporate statism.
In order for the government to take that predatory loan, you need a government to take the predatory loan. The bank can't do it by itself. Governments are always the problem. I'll close with that. That's the one thing I agree with Reagan. Like, government is not the solution. Government is the problem.
Yeah.
It's true.
Then he doubles federal spending. Anyway. So, yeah. Rhetoric. Rhetoric is magic. Yeah, exactly.
I like the rhetoric.
Well, Ryan, I want to thank you.
Hey, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Judge a man by what he does, not by what he says.
Yeah, his deeds. Like, the deeds that matter. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for coming on. It was a great talk. We're over a little over 2 hours now, so I know it's probably late where you are now, right? Midnight, perhaps?
Yeah, I thought it would be an hour, and so, it's 12:29 here. We're all good.
It's never just an hour.
So, I know. So I go, well, if I aim at an hour, it'll be two or three.
There you go. Yeah, I got to give you a little.
It was like in Michael Collins Piper. We talked for like 1 hour and 40 minutes minimal every time.
Yeah, there's no way to.
I really regret, you know, I'll tell you one last thing is I haven't told people this, but I was talking to him. We were going to do an interview about Robert Kennedy, and we were just going to just say everything. And because the anniversary of his death was coming up on June 5th, and we did a little pre thing. Didn't record it though, because we were going to do it after. Because I didn't want to drone on too much, so wanted to have a nice thing. And then he passed away just a few days later. And I was like, why didn't I just hit the button? Because I would have had that treasure trove.
Yeah. Well, so yeah.
He knew everything too. And then I was a little sad. And then I didn't want to do it by myself. You know, this is what we said. I just couldn't deal with it. So. That guy had a vast knowledge about the Kennedys, though.
He did. His book, his research on that, a whole other dimension to those assassinations. And we never talk about the Kennedy. You always talk about JFK assassination or Robert Kennedy assassination as separate events, but really most people just call them the assassinations because they're linked in so many ways. Yeah. So. Okay, well, Ryan, thanks a lot. I'll let you go, get some rest, and I wish you the best. I'll continue to follow your work, of course. And when I post this, I will send you the link. I'll probably post this pretty quickly, and I'll send you the link so you have that, so you can link it at your show so we can get maximum listeners to this thing. So
great. Excellent. You should link to Doug Valentine's new book if you can underneath or something.
Okay, yeah, I'll mention it. Yeah, when I interviewed him about the book, I had a link in there as well. Yeah, but I'll link that too. Yeah, because those and I do highly recommend your interviews with Doug Valentine. I also recommend his books, of course, The Strength of the Wolf, Strength of the Pack, Phoenix Program, and The CIA as Organized Crime. Because if you read those books, it may take you, depending on how much you like to read, a year, year and a half, you will get an understanding of
how if you think Empire really Unmasked is packed with details, just read a Doug Valentine book.
Yeah, I do both. Watch that and read that, and you'll get a greater understanding of how the world really works and what's really
going on. You really have to have a book for some stuff because there's just so many names, and you'd have to be watching it over and over and over. Yeah. And the book, it's better because once you get your head around it, it all starts making sense. You're like, wow, this is so simple now. Because it's sort of a real hidden history, right? Mm-hmm. In your faith. And then, because you have all these different explanations for these different events, well, you see what the little hidden thing that's been missing, then they're not all so different from each other. And you go, oh, it's again the same. Everything becomes clear. That's why I highly recommend those books. I'm going to approach him about making video versions of them, not by myself, but if we could do that, that would be awesome. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, all okay. Right,
man. Well, take I'll it easy, talk to you again soon. We'll not be separate for so long next time.
Yeah. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
the greetings of people in trouble, reflections of my life. Oh, how they feel my eyes. All my sorrow, sad tomorrow, take me back to my old home. All my crying, feel I'm dying, take me back to my old home.
Si volete banana!